Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlom. While we're all involved in a truly difficult time in modern American history, the fight against the novel coronavirus, COVID-19, it's a good time to look back in history for lessons in leadership, problem-solving, heroism, and survival. 50 years ago, Apollo 13 held the world's attention for a week in April as astronauts Jim Lovell, Fred Hayes, and Jack Swigert were in a pitched battle for survival after their command service module Odyssey had one of its oxygen tanks explode, which also ruptured their backup second tank. The lack of oxygen meant that the spacecraft couldn't produce two vital commodities, water and electricity. In many ways, Apollo 13 was truly fortunate in both the timing of the accident, the crew that had to deal with it, and the amazing flight controllers and engineers solving one problem after another on the ground. For example, the crew had the lunar module Aquarius to act as a lifeboat as the accident had happened before the planned lunar landing, about 55 hours into the mission. An accident much later would have likely been fatal for the crew. If you missed part one of our special, you can check it out at mynspr.org or wherever you get this podcast from. In this, the second part of our two-part special on the flight of Apollo 13, we'll hear from one of the key mission controllers, an electrical, environmental, and consumables manager, also known as ECOM, John Aaron. He and his team came up with a way to power up this crippled spacecraft after days of being shut down in the cold of space, and that saved enough precious battery power for a safe re-entry. And we'll hear from space historian and author Andrew Chaikin about the legacy of Apollo 13 for NASA and how it can inform the training of young flight controllers poised to help return to the moon with the planned Artemis program. But our first guest will take us away from inside mission control and the spacecraft and into the home of one of the astronauts during the crisis. Barbara Lovell Harrison is the daughter of Jim Lovell, the mission's commander, who, just by the way, celebrated his 92nd birthday. She was a shy 16-year-old girl at the time when the entire world was focused on her father's mission, and of course, the astronaut families drew immense media attention, with camera crews from around the world camped out literally in front of the Lovells' family home in Houston. Barbara was portrayed by actress Mary Kate Schellert in the Ron Howard movie from 1995, Apollo 13. But the real Barbara is and was quite a bit different from the movie version, and she joins us from her home in Texas. I asked her what it was like for her on the evening of the accident, April 13th, 1970.
Well, there's always people in our home during flights, and so we came in and visited with those different people, and then it was time for me to go to bed. I was going to go to school the next day. And so I went upstairs, and, you know, our bathroom, we had one bathroom and three bedrooms upstairs, and so I was in their bathroom, and it was right at the head of the stairs, the top of the stairs. And I could hear the doors opening. I could hear the telephone going. And so I kind of snuck on down and I started listening, and more people were coming over, and I wasn't sure what was going on, and it was a little frightening. And so I just went upstairs and I got into bed. And my mother's friend, Adeline Hammock, she came up to see how I was, and I pretended I was asleep. I just didn't want to talk to anyone. And then eventually my mother came up, and she, I was still awake, and she just said, "I just want you to know that there has been an explosion on board. Your dad is fine. He's coming home, but he won't be able to land on the moon." And so I was thinking everything was okay. They were just turning around and coming home. And so my first thought was, how is dad? You know, I know he's going to be disappointed. And my mom said, "He'll be fine. Don't worry." And with that, I went to bed. And it wasn't until the next morning that I went downstairs, and you can imagine, you know, people had been at my home all night, half sleeping downstairs, you know, a lot of people talking, the phone still going. And that's when my mother, you know, took me aside and told me a little bit more about how serious it was. But I really never quite understood the seriousness of it, probably until a couple days later, when they kept the TV off, they kept the press out. I didn't go to school until a couple days later. And that's when I really realized how serious it was.
Was there a point where at any point where you really started to fear for, that you might lose your father?
Oh, yes. And I don't remember what led up to it. It's a funny way that what your mind does when you go through trauma like that. And there's a lot of things I don't remember about that time period, but I do remember my best friend Connie picking me up in the car, and I don't remember how I got into the car, but I remember her picking me up, and we always went to the grocery store just to get away from everybody. And we got down there by the store, and I just started crying. And I said, I don't think he's coming home. I'm just worried. And she's a very positive person. And she just looked at me and she said, nope, he's coming home. Don't worry about it. And, so I was very fearful in that respect. And of course, all the predictions you can't help hearing when you're 16 years old, you pick up on everything. And then, there was communion, our minister came, and people were having communion, and that was a little, unsettling. Like I said, I just was a little taken back by a lot of those things that were going on.
Tell us about your mom, because, she played such a pivotal role for you as the head of the family at home. Tell us about how she helped get you all of you children and everyone through this.
Mm-hmm. She essentially held down the fort. There was a lot of people there to take care of my mother, but then she was able to take care of us. She, she took on the role of mother and father at the whole time. And she would make sure that everything was in place. If we needed to go to school, we'd get to school. Everything stayed the same, despite the commotion that was going on. And if we needed to talk to her, she was there to talk to us. And, that would be the strength of my mom. She was always, she never let things get, she didn't let us see her upset. That's when she would go into her room. Stories later that I hear about her, she would go into her room. Sometimes she'd go into the bathroom and close the door just to get away from people. But if we ever needed her, she was always there. So that's how she essentially got us through the trauma of Apollo 13.
Any lessons, because you're a parent yourself, that you learned from your mom that you sometimes you think about, as you go through dealing with your own life and, the mini and max crises we all go through with our children's. Any times you think to yourself, wow, that's something my mom would say.
Yes, she would let us go through those crises, but she was always there to, so to speak, pick up the pieces. She never intervened in a negative way. You learn from problems. And so with my children, I'm always wanting to helicopter them, even as adult children. But I've realized that, you take your hands off, you let them make mistakes, but you're always there for them. And that's how my mom was. She was always there for us. And, even though my dad was gone so much, she had to be mother and father. And the best thing I remember about my mom is she kept the family together. And when my dad wasn't there, she was everything. But when my dad came home, the toys were picked up, the house was clean, and dinner was on the table. And I just kind of have to laugh, because sometimes I think my dad was gone a lot, but the light was always on. She always expected him home. And I think that's the way she looked at it with Apollo 13. She wasn't going to look at it as any other way, but he'll be here, and then we'll deal with those issues.
Yeah. And then, okay, so two decades later, you're a grown up person now, and suddenly Hollywood and Ron Howard and Tom Hanks and et al. Decide that they are going to tell this story. Can you tell us a bit about what it was like when you first learned, they're going to turn this story that's your family story into a major Hollywood film?
Well, we were at the lake, and my dad was allowing me to read some of the, they take the book, but then they write a screenplay for it.
Oh, yeah, the adaptation.
Right. And I was reading through this, and I said, the language was so bad. And I said, Dad, your grandchildren aren't going to be able to see this, and neither will I. And he said, don't worry, don't worry. You know, Ron Howard's good about it. It'll be taken care of. So, but I got excited about it again because they wanted to know where I fit into the thing as well and where all the other children did. So it was fun, and it brought back a lot of memories for us to be interviewed in that way.
And one of my favorite things that you and I talked about before was, I believe it was Connie that was with you? What did she think of how you were portrayed in the film on screen?
She didn't like the actress that played me. And she said, the whole time she was looking at it, she said, that's not your house. You know, that's not the way you looked. You know, you weren't that big. The actress that played me was not overweight at all, but she just was imagining that it would be someone that looked just like me up there. And so, and I did the same thing with the movie. The first, you know, 10 minutes I was watching and I looked at the house and I said, that's not our house. My mother would not have had a coffee table that looked like that or a lamp. You know, they were very 70s is what they did. And so I was a little taken back by that.
And you weren't all broken up about the Beatles breaking up.
No, you know, they like to take a little license with some of those things to make a movie interesting. But I really think that, you know, they were showing that the family dynamics were the same in our family as it would be with any family, even with a parent that's gone. You know, my dad, you know, I had gone through adolescence, and all of a sudden my dad was like, oh my gosh, she's grown up. You know, where did this come from? And so I think that they were just trying to show some of the emotions and some of the things that go on in families.
And could you talk a little bit about your father, who for me as a child growing up was, you know, he was one of my biggest heroes as a kid. And when the movie came out, I couldn't help but, you know, I liked Tom Hanks, but I always felt like, well, I like the real Jim Lovell better. Tell me about what it was like for you to see, you know, this iconic American actor playing your dad.
I was just impressed with the fact that he was adamant that everything he did was accurate. It was the buttons he pushed were the right buttons. The way my dad did things, he studied my father. He just wanted to be the best Jim Lovell that he could be. So I admired him from that point of view. And he did a good job doing that.
And did they become friends?
Yes. Yep. They would visit every once in a while. I believe they still do on occasion. A number of years ago, my dad, I believe he was on an island somewhere in the Caribbean, and ran into him. And they're like, oh, so they went and had lunch and chatted a while and then went their separate ways. But they have there's a bond there. I know Tom wanted to play my dad's part when this movie came up. And he just went to Ron Howard and said, I want to play Jim Lovell. And that had always been a dream of his as well.
Yeah, and I heard that they kind of wanted Kevin Costner for that role because he kind of looks more like your dad.
Yeah, but he had the sandy blonde hair and the blue eyes, but he was playing that other movie and he couldn't get away. So that's why Tom Hanks ended up with it.
Well, I think we're all very fortunate that he did. What are a couple things in the movie that you could share with us that were not quite right? One of my favorite scenes is the scene where your mother loses her wedding ring. And when I first saw that, I thought, well, that can't possibly be true. That's just some Hollywood thing. But is it?
It's true. We were just talking to my mother last week about it. And I said, you know, some people don't think that that was a true thing. And she said, absolutely it was. She had lost a little weight and, you know, her hands were soapy and it just slipped off and it fell into the drain, but there was a little catch down there. So she got out of the shower and they came and got it out of there for her. But those things were true. The other thing that was true was my grandmother during the splashdown, right while we were waiting for the splashdown, Aldrin and Neil Armstrong, when they were in there with her, and she wanted to know if they were in the space program as well.
Oh, my.
Yeah. Are you
that
always,
is,
you know, that part.
Are you boys in the space program too? That's the funniest line. That's true. Wow, that is just amazing.
That is true. Some things that were not true was my father, if he had ever had any reservation about Jack Swigert able to do what he needed to do on that flight, he would have never gone. And they never had an argument up there, you know, about bouncing off the wall for 15 minutes and then being right back where they were. No one ever accused anyone of anything. My father said the best thing that they ever did was it was the teamwork there and the teamwork down below at Mission Control. That is what got them.
Yeah.
What got them home.
In fact, the more that I have learned about the mission, the more I respect Jack Swigert, and his physical robustness was also just, people don't think about that, but you know, when you look at the conditions those guys were under, you know, with it basically in a flying refrigerator for hour after hour, and just that cold and not being able to, you know, get away from it, his physical toughness and his abilities, you know, he really was a hero, like they all were. If you know, when I talked to John Aaron, the ECOM flight controller, he made a point to say, you know, the real heroes, you know, really are the astronauts. And they never complained. They never said, they never weren't cooperative. They were just amazing. And he wanted to make sure that I let you know that.
I'm so glad. And you know, that is the way I look at it as well. They worked together as a team, and they had trained together as a team, even though it was for a short period of time. And I love those mission controllers. And it wasn't until after Apollo 11, the anniversary last year, I got to know Gwen Griffin a little bit more, mm-hmm. and some of the other astronaut kids. And but I didn't realize what she went through as a child with her father being gone all the time. And all of those controllers, the time they spent there, and even during 13, was more than my dad ever did spend, away while he was training. And I just admired them. And then I went home and I put on Mission Control, The Unsung Heroes.
Mm-hmm.
I just stood back amazed. Just amazed at what went on during that whole time of spaceflight, but even during 13. You know, one time I even thanked Gene Kranz, and I did thank Jerry Griffin when I was there last summer. And I said, you know, it was you guys that brought him home. So they are unsung heroes, I think, in the world of NASA and NASA enthusiasts. I don't know that they really know what they've done.
Well, that's wonderful. And it's wonderful to talk to you, Barbara. I've so enjoyed getting to know you and to let you share your experiences during, you know, the crisis of Apollo 13, which really is one of NASA's finest moments, finest hours. And I know it was a crushing disappointment for your dad not to walk on the moon, but and it still has to gnaw at him a little bit. But he still, to me, you know, he's still... I will never forget Christmas Eve of 1968 and him and Frank Borman and William Anders reading from Genesis. For me, that was the high point of the entire space program, even though the landing on the moon was amazing and all the missions after.
You know, and I will say this one thing. Charles Lindbergh said to my dad, escorted him around during Apollo 11. And when they were there, my dad was pointing up saying, just think they're going to the moon. And Charles Lindbergh said, you know, I think that's great. He said, but my favorite was yours, Apollo 8. You were the first ones to leave here and to go and to come back. And so I think that's special. And in regard to my dad and the different flights that he has taken. So that's our favorite.
We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll continue our look at Apollo 13 50 years ago. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's go now to our next guest and a good friend of the program, John Aaron. Aaron was an ECOM, flight controller, which stands for Electrical, Environmental, and Consumables Manager, during the Apollo program. He was in his late 20s at the time of the Moon program and played a pivotal role in saving the Apollo 12 mission when it was hit by lightning shortly after launch in November of 1969. A few months later, he would need all of his problem-solving skills to help save Apollo 13's astronauts. With no way to use oxygen in the crippled command service module Odyssey, there was no way to produce water nor electricity. To preserve Odyssey's batteries, which were needed to re-enter Earth's atmosphere, should the mission get that far, Odyssey had to be completely powered down. Turning it back on again would prove to be a monumental team effort in problem solving that Aaron was at the heart of. John Aaron joins us from his home in Texas. John Aaron, welcome to Blue Dot.
Well, I'm glad to be here. This is one of my favorite subjects to talk about, I would expect, you suppose, yeah?
Mine too. And we're talking about Apollo 13, which is one of the flight controller's finest hours of all time. I'd like to start out by asking you, where were you when the accident actually occurred?
I was actually off shift at home. It actually was shaving when the phone call came in that something was going on in mission control.
I hope you didn't nick yourself after hearing that.
Well, you know, the thing that happened is Arnie Aldridge called me. He worked in mission control, and he said, John, I'm calling you because they're chasing a problem out here. They think it's instrumentation related. There's something wrong with the instrument, the data system. But they don't seem to be getting anywhere, and I'm concerned that maybe they're not on the right track.
And so when you got there, can you tell us about, like, you know, when it became apparent to you that you had to let them know that power was going to be the ultimate problem, because that, you know, that is your area of expertise. You are the guy as ECOM who understands the electrical and power systems. Could you tell us about that?
Well, I had kind of an advantage because when Arnie told me about it, them chasing it, assuming it was an instrumentation problem because it was a massive set of parameters that had no relationship to each other, I asked him about those to read me a few of things from those parameters because, being an instrumentation expert, I pretty much had memorized all the patterns that the instrumentation system failed in. He did that, and I summarized that quickly to him just over the phone. Arnie, that's a real problem. That's not an instrumentation problem. Pass that along, and I'll be right there. I finished dressing, got to the mission control. It was probably about an hour after the event had happened. When I walked in, the mission controllers were all trying to sort through what was going on and make sense out of it all. But based on what I had heard and what had been reported, and I'd already had a feeling it was something that was major, I realized pretty quickly that the only thing that would cause the crew to hear a loud bang, to see venting, simultaneous two fuel cells failing, one oxygen tank completely failing, and another oxygen tank going down, that it was not going to be something that you could fix. And so my first concern was power, because they had brought up one of the batteries to sustain the spacecraft while they were troubleshooting. So I walked over to the other ECOM that was on shift there, and I said, you know, you're not going to be able to fix this. We got to power the command module down. He said, power it down. I said, yeah, to zero. You got to turn it completely off because we're using the batteries. And if we ever get a chance to get back in the vicinity of the Earth, we're going to have those batteries to get home. That kind of got the snowball rolling to change the focus of the what was going on in the mission control center there.
And the other ECOM, was that Cy Liebergott?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was.
So you knew pretty much right away, you know, that this was not, like you said, an instrumentation problem. In other words, you know, these aren't just readings coming in from some faulty, you know, switch or something like that. This is a real, actual problem.
Yes, I did. I had thought about it on the way to work when I got out there, that this is likely a massive structural problem, because there's nothing about the instrumentation system measurements that they were looking at that were tied together and sympathetic to each other except common structure. And that got me on the path quickly to the fact that this is an emergency. We got to power it down and save the batteries. And fortunately, we're still connected to the lunar module, and it started pretty much right away how to change the focus to be get in the lunar module and get it powered up, save the trajectory and the navigation parameters and the guidance parameters, transfer those to the lunar module, and power down the spacecraft.
And had you guys ever simulated in all of your practicing for the Apollo missions, powering down the command module like this and then knowing you'd have to power it back up?
No, it was not something that we ever thought was credible, even though we used to, you know, train some pretty incredible things, but we never trained that as a credible thing to do. I do think the LIM guys told me one time that the simulation scheme or scenario they were doing one day got away from them, and they kind of backed into it, but they didn't pursue it. So the spacecraft had never been powered down before. It's a zero, nor powered up from scratch in space.
Yeah, and we'll get to that later, but I'd like you to go to a famous meeting with Gene Kranz. Can you kind of take us into that room and tell us what that was like?
Yes. I worked for about 2 hours with the controllers there, getting the command module powered at an orderly power down. But of course, once you get the command service module all turned off and dead, there's nothing to do for me in the control center or any ECOM in the control center. So we moved out of the control center into a side meeting hall. And as I was sitting there with Jim Kelly, one of the guys that I worked very, very closely with, and we were just kind of joined at the hip, technically, we started thinking about if the WIMP can get us back, what have we got? And, you know, I started thinking, well, if it takes 6 hours to power up the command module, I didn't know how long it was going to be. That normally takes enough power that it would take 240 amp hours of battery power to do that about, and we only had probably 100 at most. And so we were 2.5. What we had capability to do was less than 2.5 worth. You know, it took 2.5 more than what we had to do when you just look how it would happen nominally. And so about that time, Gene Kranz walked in the room, the flight director, who was on shift when this happened. And I guess he saw us sitting there kind of with this gloomy look on her face. And so he kicked off a little pep talk. He said, okay, heads up, everybody. The lunar module is all powered up. The guidance system's all aligned. And we're going to do a maneuver here with the lunar rocket engine to put us up back on a free return trajectory. That's going to whip us around the back of the moon and head toward Earth. When we get to the Earth, we'll power up this thing and normally and do entry. Well, you know, based on I thought we had a 2.5 time reduction of what we needed, I just spoke up and said, Gene, you can't do that. And he said, what do you mean, Econ? What do you mean you can't do that? I said, you don't have enough power. And there was dead silence in the room for about 2 or 3 seconds. And then he did something that was indicative of what a strong leader he was. He just says, okay, ECOM, anybody that needs any power, got to see the ECOM. John, you're in charge of power. You're in charge of how to power this thing up. Well, and then he left the room.
Well, let's go forward to now it's time, you know, we've gone around the moon and, you know, it's time to power this spacecraft back up. And that is no easy task. Could you give us all a sense of how difficult that was and how long it took to come up with just the procedures to do it? And then how long it took to get that up to the astronauts?
Okay. Well, I can tell you that it took the remainder of the mission to do it. We worked on that from the time that we left that room that I just described where Kranz gave that responsibility all the way until it became super critical that, and running out of time. We started right away. We powered the command module down about 59 hours into the mission. We started developing the plan. The plan then turned into all the details. The details all got worked out and verified in the flight trainers with the astronauts. It took from that 59-hour point about all the way down to 125 hours. That's like 2.5 days after we started working on the plan before we started reading it up. Very close to the end of the mission. It was, we were at the 125-hour point in the mission when they started reading up the plan that we had delivered to the flight director in the mission control. And it took 2.5 hours to read up all the details and discuss all of the things that this plan did to power up this spacecraft in a way that it had never been powered up before. Normally, when you get ready to launch a spacecraft, this command service module, you go out and start powering it up on the pad 3 days ahead of time. And you spend 3 days powering it up and checking it out. We had developed a plan, and we've shrunk the timeline down to where we were going to do it in 5.5 hours.
Wow. So it took 2.5 hours. Just to give them the instructions.
I tell you how close it was. When we finished reading it up, 9 hours later, Jack Swigert, the astronaut, took a flashlight and went down into the command module and started preparing the spacecraft to be powered up. It was that close.
So he's in this cold, dark spacecraft with just a flashlight, and he's got to get everything done exactly right according to these procedures. And how did he do?
Well, first of all, we could not give him the advantage of turning on all the comm system and all the telemetry so that we could watch it on the ground. We didn't have enough power to do that. So literally, you're right, he went down into the command module. We didn't allow him to turn on a bunch of lights with a flashlight, and he had two main jobs. One, he had to configure the command and service module to power up at least the pyrotechnic system so that the first thing we had to do is get rid of the service module. It was still attached, but it was dead, and it didn't have any power within itself to back away when he did the separation. So the first task was to configure the spacecraft to separate the service module. Which we worked out the procedure, do a little push-pull maneuver with the lunar module thrusters so that it wouldn't change the trajectory. So we did a push, he hit the button, the service module separated, and then did a pull of about 1 foot per second. That he then switched his attention to doing this all in the dark with a flashlight. We didn't have any data on the ground. For about 2.5 hours, he went about configuring all the switches, getting the batteries on the line, powering up the inertial navigation system platform, starting to get it aligned and so forth. And then 2.5 hours later, or 3 hours before the entry, he was to turn everything on, turn the data system on so we could see on telemetry how it was going. And when we turned it on, the spacecraft was essentially powered up, pretty much aligned, and he had executed this long checklist that took 2.5 hours to read up. and he had done it perfectly.
Wow.
We found one minor thing that was different, and that turned out to be a wiring error in the spacecraft.
So he performed perfectly.
Yeah, the spacecraft was at full power. By delaying turning on the comm system, the instrumentation system, and scratching the timeline, then we were able to power the spacecraft up for the last 3 hours at about the 3/4 of the power level. Then normally you would have been running about 40 amps for about 6 hours, which is, of course, 2.5 times what battery power we had when we built this plan. The next thing to do was to check all the alignments, check all the systems that were up, and make sure it was all configured right. And then we started a maneuver that Jim and Fred, while they were in the limb, to maneuver the spacecraft stack such that we could separate the lunar module from the command module. That was accomplished by the procedure that Jim Kelly suggested. It's like Jim Kelly suggested how to do the push-pull maneuver to get the service module away. The idea then was to put all three crewmen in the command module, close the hatch, leave some pressure in the tunnel that connected the two vehicles together, and then pyrotechnically separate the lunar module and turn it loose. With the pressure in the tunnel, that would give it enough of a bump give you some separation distance between the service module, between the command module and the lunar module.
Let's take a short break. I'm Dave Schloman. You are listening to Blue Dot as we look back at Apollo 13 50 years ago. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with flight controller John Aaron. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's continue now in our conversation with flight controller John Aaron. In his late 20s at the time, Aaron led the effort to figure out how to turn the electrical power back on for the crippled spacecraft Odyssey 50 years ago in April of 1970 during the Apollo 13 mission. You know, we think of Apollo 13 as being unfortunate, but in so many ways, it was incredibly fortunate. You mentioned something to me the other day about when the oxygen tank exploded. You know, if it had been later, that would have been a disaster because you could have been separated from the lunar module and not had your lifeboat. And then you would have really been, you know, lost this crew and lost the mission, most likely. But you also mentioned something that it could have happened, you know, before, like on the launch pad.
When you look at the investigation of that oxygen tank after we got back and the investigation was done on that, it was clear that that oxygen tank had been abused in a way that it was laying there. That problem was laying there from the time we filled that oxygen tank before we loaded, before we launched, until we got to the 56-hour point in the mission. You know, it just so happens when we were in free space and you have a big structural problem and you blow the whole set out of the service module, there was nothing around it to interact with, the debris I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Imagine the thing that would give you cold chills is to think, well, we were sitting on a launch pad with all three of those stages of that Saturn V fueled. If that had happened when we were on with the crew in there getting ready to counting down the spacecraft, if that had happened then and a piece of shrapnel had come off and ricocheted off of the launch tower and penetrated one of the tanks in one of those stages, you know, you can just imagine what might have happened there.
The explosive equivalent of a small atomic bomb.
Yeah. So It's just the Apollo program, there were a number of things that happened that were bad, but we were able to survive and recover. But sometimes it was because we were only in a certain portion of the mission where we had the capability to do that.
Yeah.
You know, it was just, there's an element of luck and maybe a little divine intervention along the way.
Certainly on Apollo 13. A last question for you. Can you describe the moment for us when you really realized, you know, I think we're going to make it here. What was that point?
Well, it happened in two phases. One was when we got the sequence done, we had designed a sequence so we had some time at the end in case we needed to redo something. And that was about 45 minutes or an hour that the crew was all set to enter the atmosphere with the spacecraft. And it was all ship shape and ready to go. Then I started feeling, hey, this looks like it's going to work. This looks like it's going to work. And so that was the first time I started to relax just a little bit that we've got this close. It's all come together. But then you sit there and you start thinking about, well, we've got to get through the atmosphere. That is no small deal. Get this spacecraft to get through the atmosphere, because there were things we couldn't check. We couldn't check the parachutes in the cold. They'd been in the cold. We couldn't check the heat shield. Suppose the heat shield was damaged because the oxygen tank was just right under where the heat shield was or close by. So I started to think, well, We got as much as we can do. We have done all we can do, and it's come out pretty good. But we got to get through the atmosphere. But then, when you get through the atmosphere, you're supposed to come out of blackout and get in real store calm, and it didn't happen on time. And then we sat there for a couple, three very long minutes saying, uh-oh, what happened? Is this it? And then all of a sudden, the comm system comes alive. People are talking on the comm system. And the next thing I know, it didn't seem like it would be just a couple of minutes. You see someone in the helicopter's got a TV camera aimed at the spacecraft, and you see that command module floating and swaying and hanging on those three beautiful chutes. You know?
Wow.
That's what it really came to terms with. We conditionally hadn't done this. We had actually done it.
Yeah. And I bet you were pretty exhausted after that.
Totally. Totally exhausted.
No splashdown party for you.
No. In fact, I don't even know how many actually went to splashdown party. I know. I just folded up my books and went home and went to bed.
Thanks to retired NASA flight controller John Aaron for his memories of Apollo 13. Let's listen now to some of the real audio of Aaron's team's power-up procedures being methodically done, switch by switch, aboard the command module Odyssey. The voices you hear are astronaut Capcom Vance Brand in Houston and command module pilot Jack Swigert in the cold and dark with nothing but a flashlight aboard Odyssey.
Why don't you read that back, Jack?
Okay, let me give you all of panel 225 again. CB flight bus main B closed. CB CTE main B closed.
Finally, we're joined by Andrew Chaikin. He's the author of what many, including yours truly, consider the seminal work about the Apollo program, A Man on the Moon. NASA calls on Andy to teach the current era of space program employees about the lessons from the golden age of space exploration that was Project Apollo. I asked Andy about the legacy of the flight of Apollo 13.
I've spent a lot of time about the lessons Apollo has to teach us about success and failure in spaceflight. And I've been teaching that material at NASA, in fact. And I always point out that Apollo 13 is a tremendous lesson in success, because even though the mission itself did not succeed in, you know, in what they wanted to do, they did get those guys back against overwhelming odds. And one of the most important lessons of that is what I call what-if thinking. It's the whole process of sitting down, you know, years before you actually fly, and saying, what are we going to do if X happens? What are we going to do if Y happens? What are the failures that could bite us at any stage of a mission? And if they happen, what's our plan B? And in some cases, we need a plan C. They did things on Apollo 13 that were thought up years before the mission actually flew. And that paid enormous dividends when the crisis hit. Now, it was also aided by some brilliant ingenuity in real time, but you got to have both.
Yeah, it's an amazing story and inspiring for, you know, engineers now to look back and draw those lessons from, because there will be a time in a future space flight when similar types of challenges are faced.
Let me give you one more, which came from a conversation that I had with Jerry Griffin, who was one of the flight directors on that mission.
I know him well.
He told me about during the mission, he and Gene Kranz and some of the others had gotten together to figure out what to do. What was the best way to bring the guys home? And when they had that figured out, they went to the VIP viewing room, which looks over Mission Control. And there was Tom Paine, the administrator of NASA, and some of his people from headquarters. And, you know, Jerry Griffin got up and he explained what their thinking was, and he waited. He waited for pushback. He waited for them to say, well, wait a minute, why haven't you thought about X, Y, and Z? There was silence, nothing, for a long moment. And finally, Tom Paine said, what can we do to help you?
Yeah.
And Jerry said that he just was, he felt a chill, and he said it was so incredible because he realized, oh my God, we did it. We pitched this thing and they're just letting us do what we think is best. And that was a hallmark of the Apollo leadership culture. The guys who were in charge of NASA knew that the people down below them, the people like the flight directors and the flight controllers, they were the closest to the problem. They knew the most about how to solve it, and they let them have their head.
Gosh, could we use that kind of leadership now?
Well, we can always use it, and that's one of the great lessons of Apollo. It's a leadership culture that we should really learn and emulate.
Yeah. Years later, after Apollo 13, you're working on your book, and you write this wonderful book, A Man on the Moon, and then the film Apollo 13 comes out, and you know draws attention back to the Apollo program, and then Tom Hanks decides to do a miniseries for HBO From the Earth to the Moon, and uses your book as source material. So how much does, you know, when you look back at this, how much is this, you know, really meant to you personally?
Oh my God. It's just, I feel incredibly blessed in my life to have grown up with Apollo, to have had that incredible experience of growing up watching humans going into space and going to the moon, and then to actually get to know the people who did it. Not just the astronauts, but the engineers, the managers, the mission controllers, the geologists who trained them. These people have become friends and mentors to me, and I feel extraordinarily blessed in my life to have grown up and become a storyteller of Apollo. And now, in my current incarnation, to use the lessons of Apollo as a way of teaching the new generation of folks at NASA and elsewhere what it takes to do hard things like spaceflight and space exploration.
Before we go, let's listen in on the triumphant moment when Odyssey's three main parachutes finally opened before splashing down in the Pacific. You can hear the cheers and mission control signaling, to paraphrase Jim Lovell, the end of a long voyage with many changes of fortune.
Coming up now for main chutes.
Odyssey Houston, we show you on the mains. It really looks great.
An extremely loud applause here in Mission Control.
Thanks again to our guests, Barbara Lovell Harrison, John Aaron, and Andrew Chaikin. If you missed part one of our special on Apollo 13, you can check it out at our website, mynspr.org, or wherever you get this podcast from. A special thank you to Jerry Griffin for helping me to line up all of the amazing people we were able to interview for these programs. And a big shout out to all four of the amazing flight directors who helped lead the effort to bring Apollo 13 home. The three G's, Jerry Griffin, Glenn Lunny, and of course, lead flight director Gene Kranz, who was portrayed by Ed Harris in the 1995 Ron Howard film, and the fourth member of the team, Milt Windler. The flight controllers and engineers who worked around the country on this effort in the spring of 1970 are too numerous to mention, but all of them are true heroes. But nobody was much more heroic than the crew who endured the cold and stress and worked so well with Mission Control in Houston to get home safely. Sadly, command module pilot Jack Swigert, whose near flawless performance on the mission can't be overstated, passed away from cancer in 1982. But Commander Jim Lovell and his wife Marilyn are still partners in life and heads of their amazing family, and special thanks to lunar module pilot Fred Hayes, who joined us for part one. For you and your family dealing with the real-life problems of the economic and social upheaval of the coronavirus pandemic, I wish you Godspeed, and I hope that these special programs gave you some perhaps much-needed inspiration. Hang in there, just like Jim, Jack, and Fred did 50 years ago. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. You can revisit this and past episodes at mynspr.org, or better yet, subscribe to our podcast on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is produced and engineered by the maestro, Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of A Dog Named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.